Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keene, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest needs very little introduction for long-time listeners of the podcast. It is his probably 9th appearance on the podcast, 10th appearance on the podcast, maybe, Paul Dermody. So one of my inner circle, one of my closest friends in this world, one of my favorite people on the planet. Today's episode is exactly what you would expect from a Paul Dermody episode. For those of you where this is your first time listening to this, it's a very fly-on-the-wall style conversation where we talk on a few points, especially the first half is very much nutritional-based. So talking about nutritional principles, unlearning diet behavior, the problem of black and white thinking around food. And then the second half gets very much into kind of life and mindset as our conversations tend to go. Again, no pre-planning apart from a couple of bullet points on topics I wanted to cover for this one. And it's just a very ebb and flow conversation back and forth. As very obvious split halfway through. It goes from talking very nutritional mindset around food and what are the basic things you need to do in order to hit any body compositional goals. And then we transition out to the mindset stuff. So talking about some of the things that are going on in life, some of the misconceptions we have and belief systems we've had in certain areas of our lives and kind of deconstructing and basically just doing a duo therapy session where we are having a conversation like we would normally have and have just pressed record and captured it for the podcast. So I'm not going to spend any more time in the introduction because the episode goes a little bit longer as the episodes of Paul Dermody normally go. So without further ado, here is today's podcast with one of my favorite people, one of my inner circle, Paul Dermody, on nutrition principles, unlearning diet behavior, and the problem with black and white thinking. Enjoy. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Generally, we start these podcasts very differently anytime I have today's guest on because sometimes we chat beforehand and then we press record. Other times we just press record and start talking. So me and my guest of today, one of my favorite people on the planet, who is back for what has to be his 78th appearance on the podcast at this stage, Paul Dermody. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back on. 79, I believe.
Yeah, you're one of the most requested guests of all time consistently. So every time we leave it a few months, I always get the DMs. When is Paul back on? When is Paul back on? When are you going to do a random episode? When are you going to do a show where you're just chatting about everything? Literally, it happened last week because I linked up. Trish was on a couple of weeks ago, Trisha Lewis. And I linked up the episode that we all did together in the new year. And there was a load of re-listens on that. And people were like, oh, get Paul back on the podcast. I'm like, Paul, are you ready? Do we do another round? So welcome back on.
Thank you. That's remarkably humbling. And I'm looking forward to it because I don't know if this happens to you, but you know your old stuff. You cringe a little bit on what you used to think and who you used to be. So it's a nice chance to rectify anything I've said in the past that makes me go, oh, I used to think that.
You said a line to me before that has always stuck with me. It's one of the Paulisms that I've mentioned on the podcast, but to be fair, I always give you credit first. And it's the, always give yourself permission to change your mind. And that's what I think about a lot of ideas. When I listen back to some of our older podcasts, particularly like the really early days ones where we have opinions on this, that, or the other. And then you listen back to it, you know, with fresh eyes in, you know, September 2020 or whenever it is, you're like, oh, fuck. Like, it's like, shit, I don't know if I believe that anymore. Or I've thought that now and I think about it on a deeper level. Out of curiosity, anything jump to mind that in terms of, again, it might be a fitness thing, a nutrition thing, it might be just a life thing in general, because I know you're kind of an avid thinker. Is there anything that jumps to mind where you're like, oh, man, this is what I thought 2-3 years ago, and I don't believe this to be true at all anymore?
Oh, that's a question. There's probably many things, though. It's hard to think of one off the cuff. I think with a little bit more age and maturity, I'm starting to become very aware of, you know, particularly now in social media age where everyone's got extremely loud opinions on an extremely vast amount of things. All I have to do is think about my interest in nutrition is the highest in life, just with the fact that it's my career. So nutrition and mechanics. And there's something about understanding like how much I have to learn. And if I have to put that much attention into nutrition and client psychology and realize, holy shit, I'm only scratching the surface. It just makes me very aware of my own ignorance in pretty much everything else. So I'm very much resisting the urge to hold strong opinions on other things. Strong opinions with a loose grip, perhaps, whereby non-attachment. But yeah, I'm just not as hot and bothered about things anymore. I'm a lot better at letting things go as I get a little bit older.
I think that gives me a nice little segue, because something I did want to talk on and get into it nice and early in the podcast is the nutrition side. Because for those of who are longtime listeners, for those who follow me on Instagram or message, like, I've sent so many people your direction, because I'm one of those coaches that genuinely believes I'm in a fantastic fit for some people and my program's a great fit for some people, but equally that same great fit for one person makes it a terrible fit for somebody else. So when people message me and they have insert problem here with nutrition or behavior around food, I'm like, look, I actually think Paul Dermody is going to be a better fit for you. So I've sent multiple people your way for that reason. And one thing I want to touch on, and we'll definitely get into the food and nutritional psychology today as well, but you put up a post recently about principles versus absolutes. Can you tell people listening, just because this isn't something we've talked on in a previous podcast, and I think it's very valuable when it comes to nutritional advice in general, your theory on having principles versus having absolutes when it comes to your nutrition?
Yes, sir. And I also do need to give you a tremendous amount of thank you. I have actually gotten quite a few referrals who have mentioned they've come on your specific recommendation. And also being on this podcast has helped quite a lot. You're like the Irish Joe Rogan right now, but I've had a lot of referrals from you, and it doesn't go unnoticed. So thank you for that. It is also a good sign that you do refer people that who you think would be a better fit, as opposed to, you know, make your money the wrong way. I always think that's quite a noble thing. To your question, principles and absolutes. Yeah, I've gotten a little bit more obsessed with this, probably because when I was a little bit younger, I think you will attest to this both about me and without speaking for you, I think we shared this. I had a very black and white worldview because it suited my need to have the answer, you know, to like, I don't care how detrimental this answer might be in my own life. It's better to have the answer than to bask in uncertainty and need to understand context. So I had very, very absolute thinking. I remember believing in starvation mode, right? And I think it was my friend Ken, or was it my mom, that just goes, but by that logic, would prisoners of war and people in third world countries not gain weight instead of die? And I was like, oh my God, that someone with no interest in nutrition has ripped apart a philosophy that I hold in one sentence. So that's just one small example. So then I kind of got a little bit into the kind of the scientific method, so to speak. And that is more so that if you hold a belief that isn't falsifiable, that is, if you don't feel it can be disproven, you probably don't have a scientific belief. You probably have a bit of an obsession, a bit of an ideology, whatever you want to call it. So I started thinking, when would something not apply? Because I've been a very black and white thinker. I'm almost embarrassed to admit I didn't eat sugar for like a full year because I thought sugar was inherently fattening, without thinking of the context, in what quantity, etc. So principle and absolutism, I think absolutes are when you derive a hard opinion without being able to see the other side. And when you understand a principle-based mindset, it allows you to kind of make decisions based on context. For example, you know this, if you walk into a gym and you want to do a push exercise, let's say you want to do some kind of horizontal push, bench press is your goal. If you see the bench press is taken, you're short for time. The absolutist mindset says, you know, workout ruined. The principle-based mindset says, what other movement can mimic a push? Similar with diet. You're on the go. You know, you eat a bag of crisps. You weren't intending to. And then the absolute mindset, and I think we've all been guilty of this, is diet ruined. Fuck it. I'll start Monday. But the principle-based mindset's a little bit more, I can make this fit the bigger picture. You know, there's pros and cons. No decision is without consequence, that kind of thing. And sometimes life just happens. So I've been trying to very much educate my client base and my following base not to get lost in absolute thinking, not to catastrophize and go into this need to develop hardcore answers, usually negative when it's around diet, you know, usually overly self-punishing, overly self-restrictive, and usually results in what I consider to be quite toxic diet cycles. Not for everybody, obviously, but a particular kind of person that gravitates towards me likes to work with me almost on the basis that I can very much relate to that because that's how I used to be. But yeah, you know what I was saying, it suited my worldview to have the black and white thinking. And you might agree, as you, again, as you get a little bit older, you begin to realize when you're helping and working with so many other people, you can see the context in other people's life much greater than they can when you're not attached to the journey.
The follow-up to that, and I was going to go in a direction about diet ideology, but you mentioned a few things there that I definitely want to pull out. Why do you think, and this is something I've wanted to talk about you for a while, and we haven't talked about this just because of just the way COVID has been, and we haven't caught up as often as what we generally do. And one of the girls I sent to you, she lives actually quite close to me, Demelza, and she was talking about you, singing your praises one day about how she's like, he makes me think about my food. She's like, he makes me think. And I'm like, yeah, Paul is the king of context. I'm like, it's all about the context. But why do you think, and I'm curious just from your experience, because you really handle and deal with people who are stuck in a very fixed mindset when it comes to diet ideology or to nutrition in general. And what has been your experience with, why do people, I won't say have a diet ideology, because I can understand why someone would be a massive vegan advocate or a keto advocate, etc., or somebody that has done a diet, it's worked really well for them, and they're promoting it to everybody else because it has a very positive effect on them. But a lot of the people that come to you are people who don't have a very good relationship with food from the get-go, or else they have miseducation around food. Why do you think it is that people gravitate towards eating a certain way or having a poor relationship with food when they're clearly not getting the results from that diet? And one thing that I've thought about, and I'm curious to hear your perspective on this, is similar to the vegan and keto I said earlier. When someone gets the results, I can totally see why they would promote it, why they would preach it. But a lot of people you work with think that they need to eat a certain way, think they need to avoid certain foods, think there's good foods and bad foods, yet they still haven't lost or aren't losing any weight. Why do you think they still gravitate to the old way of thinking when it comes to their nutrition?
Because I think we've been led to believe that a diet is something that you're either on or off with no middle ground. I always look at this idea of false dichotomies, dichotomy thinking, you know, two equally opposing things, that a diet is something that we do or don't do. I don't think we understand the context, the bigger picture. I don't think we understand the external principle and merge that with a more internal philosophy, set of values, identity, if you like. For example, I understand the principle of calorie balance well, and I skipped the gym today and had two pizza slices. That's my internal philosophy today. Skip the gym and have two pizza slices, but I still understand the principle and it suits my life. And I feel that leads to a false dichotomous thinking of, well, I fucked it now, what's the point? And then it leads to perhaps the false internal belief, when I'm good, I'm good, but when I'm bad, I'm bad. And then I think a very simple analogy to try and counteract that thinking. And again, I don't want to make things overly simple. I just want to get people thinking, if I save 10 euros a day for 6 days a week and I spend 100 on the seventh, I'm not good sometimes and bad sometimes. I'm just down 40 euro at the end of the week. That's really it. And that's kind of the way I see things like calorie balance. But then you can't get too obsessed with calorie balance to the point it takes your life away. For example, I mentioned my own indulgence today. I think you need to have your own identity. Like, I can't imagine you're going to go for pizza today. I don't think you love pizza, but I want some pizza. So it is about merging. Me and you both understand the principle. We both understand what role we wanted to play in our lives. And I'm trying to get clients to do that. I'm trying to get people to spend a period of time focusing on the external, the logging, the tracking, understanding what is in which, because a lot of people are under the illusion that they don't eat a lot of food, which could be true. But what they're doing is they're eating a lot of calories, just not food volume, i.e. oils, creamy coffees, hyperpalatable junk foods, which doesn't take up a lot of space in the stomach, but it's high in calories. And then we go into these restrictive, crazy, low calorie diets without actually changing the internal, the intrinsic drive, the reason behind it. And maybe I think it, to a degree, and again, I'm hypothesizing with this one, I think we're just a little bit conditioned to, or deconditioned to the fact that real progress is kind of unspectacular day-to-day processes that don't really look like much. Like, if you have a to-do list, it's not that spectacular to drink water, eat an apple, and get 8,000, 9,000 steps in a day. But if you did that every day for 365 days, you'd be a little bit closer to the goal within the context, of course. So that is what comes to mind.
I'm going to unpack that a small bit. I just finished reading a book, book by Steven Pinker. The name escapes me now. It's How Are Better Angels of something with better angels in the title. It's a big fucking book. It took me ages to get through it. But there's a section in there that really made me think. He talked about human nature, second nature, and third nature. Are you familiar with third nature at all?
No, I'm not familiar with this concept from the book.
Okay, so the concept is human nature is the things that, you know, we just do by human nature. Urge for sex, urge for food, urge for sleep. Human nature. Things that are just kind of inbuilt. They're inside everybody. They're an intrinsic thing, etc. Second nature is the things we learned. So things like speaking, you know, the language, the way we behave, the conditioning that we have as kids. That's second nature. Things that aren't necessarily the same for everybody, but based on environment and based on our upbringing and based on multiple things, we have this second nature to us. And the third nature is where you get to the process of unlearning the things that happened in second nature. And that section of the book fucking really jumped out on me because I was like, okay, you would go through, I was thinking about it in the timeline of my own life. Like I'm 33 at the end of this year and I'm like, right, human nature, all the things that are there since I was a kid, since I was, you know, 6 months old, human nature, I was learning to speak, all of these things that were going around me, the second nature, the language which I spoke, the behaviors around food, the behaviors around my mindset, all these things. And now I'm at the stage where you have to put a kind of objective eye or even a subjective eye from the case of your own life on the things that you do. So unlearning and kind of the language I put on this very Brian Keane language, I'm like unfucking myself. I'm like, what beliefs have I had that I need to question now? You know, we say a lot about when it comes to food, it's like splitting food into good and bad choices. I'm like, you know, you're not fucking 5 years old. I'm like, there's no good or bad food. There's high calorie food and there's low calorie food and there's high nutrient dense food and there's low nutrient dense food. There's supportive foods based on a goal and there's unsupportive food based on a goal. But there's no real good or bad food. It's like you're not 5 years old. And that book talks about unlearning. And the third nature is what you get when you go back and question the things that were your belief systems from your second nature or when you were growing up. Do you think when it comes to nutrition, the problem isn't learning? It's a unlearning of sort or a deconditioning of sort when it comes to their association with food or nutrition in general? Or do you think it's a combination of both?
Unlearning is absolutely so crucial. That's a wonderful concept, by the way. I think me and you have had our periods of unlearning things. Like I know, for example, I would have a wonderful, luckily, I would be fortunate to have a wonderful relationship with my family. But my family see the world through the eyes of employees and security. And would you believe security isn't a value of mine? I know that sounds a bit daft, but I'd rather take a gamble. I'd rather jump and then hope I learn to fly. That's the way I see the world. It's the way I've always seen the world to a degree. I've just learned to channel it correctly. And my family don't share that sentiment, but they're super supportive. They never put doubt in me, but they don't understand it. But I had to unlearn a lot of the conditioning around things like money, limitations. That's a big one. And that's kind of the, and I had to learn around nutrition. Jesus Christ, absolutely. That's my biggest truth. I learned so much about nutrition from the wrong places. Like the truth of the matter was at 16, I was trying low carb diets that bodybuilders with 20 years training experience, probably years of enhancement drugs were doing. And I was trying to do the same with no muscle on my frame, for example. So I had to unlearn a lot of those behaviors by kind of figuring that really wasn't the life I wanted anyway. I think it's important that we get our advice from solid, reliable, evidence-based sources in which are going to fill our minds with context and principles, as I alluded to earlier. But also forget this idea that what we've learned before, if it's not working, like how many clients of yours have come from slimming clubs where they put, for example, progress on a weighing scale as the number one metric of success, even though it technically doesn't actually make sense to have that as the sole metric of success. I definitely think unlearning a lot of what is taught to us is one of the most fundamental parts of life.
Yeah, it's so true. Like, when I read the concept, I had heard unlearning before, and I kind of heard of the kind of the philosophy. I'd never heard it put in the way of human nature, second nature, third nature. And this is the byproduct of having looked back and reflected on all the things you do that are second nature that aren't necessarily supporting your life. We all have versions of that. Like, you know, I was lucky in the sense that it wasn't too bad with the nutrition side. You know, for me, it was always in the relationship side. I had to do a lot of self-reflection and deep reflection on asking yourself why, you know, you weren't feeling worthy or why you would push people away and all these things that were either trauma based or a way to protect yourself from being vulnerable or surrendering to somebody else or whatever it was. And we all have versions of that that we need to completely just put nearly an objective eye on. I don't even think it's helpful to look at it from a, you know, I'm Paul Dermody, I'm Brian Keane, I'm insert your name here. It's very much a, okay, what's the story? What have I told myself over and over again that, you know, and I've talked about this in books and podcasts that like belief systems are just opinions that have been reinforced over and over again. I'm like, if you tell yourself something enough, it'll become a belief system and then it's very, very difficult to change. But that unlearning process for food, that unlearning process for, you know, in the context of, as you said, Paul, when it comes to job security or when it comes to relationships or whatever it is, I think it's a very, if people take nothing away from today's podcast, that word on what do you need to unlearn? Like what is in your life right now that you need to unlearn? You have learned an unsupportive behavior or a bad habit, or you have let some story take hold and grip and you've reinforced that opinion over and over again till it's a belief system, and you really need to unlearn that in order to move forward. So I think that's a really, it's just something I need to reflect on at the end of today's podcast. I'm going to go back and check in on that just because it's not something I've thought about completely recently. I hadn't planned on talking about that prior to the podcast, but you mentioned there the weighing scale metric, which is definitely something people need to unlearn in terms of a segue. But you also touched earlier, Paul, on intrinsic drives, kind of getting that internal motivation. What are your thoughts or what is your philosophy? And I know you're very good with this because of the human behavior and psychology angle that you take and the aspects that you cover when you're working with people. How do you get people to tune into an intrinsic drive versus something like an external driver like the weighing scale? So I step on the scale, I will feel I'm worthy or I'll feel I've done well if this number is lower. If it's higher, I'll feel, fuck it, I didn't do what I was supposed to do. I'm terrible. You know, I'm a bad person. this isn't what you're saying to yourself, but this is how it can manifest in people. Like, you know, I've laughed because I've done it myself in other areas where your own biggest enemy being between your two ears. But how do you get people to switch from the external metric to something that's an intrinsic driver for motivation?
I think when I'm working with someone, one of the things I really want to do is get them to talk about what they'd actually like to achieve with the process, which sounds a bit cliche, and I don't want to lose any listeners because it sounds super cliche. But I want to get people to tune into their own internal self. And that's not as cheesy as it sounds. Like, for example, I believe it is actually the anticipation of almost everything that we look that is better than the moment itself. And I can attest to it. The anticipation for me personally, and I think the anticipation for most of us of things like pizza or particular moments, generally tends to be better than the moment itself. So one little exercise I do if somebody is struggling a little bit to kind of feel that perception of control around food is, well, first and foremost, ask them to just be a bit mindful next time they decide to have the food, which sounds a bit basic. But the other thing I get them to do is actually literally try and taste and almost internally rate every single bite. And you'd be surprised how many people have actually said to me, you know, I actually stopped and tasted the pizza and the first slice was delicious, so was the second. And by the third, I was like, you know what? I'm a bit done now. Once I tuned into my more mindful senses, I was a bit done. And that's a really useful thing to do because pizza and chocolate and those kind of foods are the kind of foods that are super easy to overeat when you don't give any thought to it. They're hyper palatable. They're generally high in fats and carbs, hence why they're calorific. Generally low in nutrients, blah, blah, blah. You get it. So I think it's almost that fear of, if I eat X food, this food, I'm going to be a bad person. It is the good and bad absolutist thinking that we don't challenge. Like, it's all well and good understanding calorie balance, as I keep saying, but if you don't have a particular idea of what you're hoping to get from food, first and foremost, but if you're working with a trainer from a transformation, if you don't know what you're looking to get out of it, and that's what I talk to clients about, then I nearly think you're just doing the exact same cycle again, just it might be with a different restriction. So a lot of diets, and I know I'm putting a lot of emphasis on diet here, but it's probably the thing I love the most in the world right now, this work. a lot of diets are so restrictive, they leave us out of touch with our actual intuitive hunger. You know, they're just external rules and nothing else. But if you do eat intuitively, it's highly unlikely you will intuitively want to eat in a caloric deficit, for example. So I think it's about merging the two. Knowing when is a good time to indulge. Being mindful in all your decisions. Being able to have a half a chocolate bar and put the other half away in the knowledge you can always have a half of it later. I once thought that was impossible, for example, back to black and white thinking. You know, being able to say no now in the knowledge that food will always be there. You know, I believe that's food will always be there. You know, don't worry if you're thinking about tidying up your nutrition tonight. Don't have a last supper tonight. Food will always be there. It's not going anywhere next week. And there are many things in life that create impulsive behaviors in all of us, certainly speaking from my own experience. So I do think that element of slowing down, making sure that we're not filling a void, making sure that we do have an actual intrinsic desire of what we're looking to get from a transformation. I can only speak for myself on this one. I'm a lot happier at about 10% body fat higher than when I was the bodybuilding competing days. I'm a lot happier now with a lot more body fat on my bones because I can balance life in the way I want to. Like right now, I enjoy my work. I enjoy the bits and bobs that I'm doing, my social life. I've met some wonderful friends here in Vietnam. I go for a few beers twice a week with some friends. The consequence of that is I don't get to be at peak body fat. I'm still active. I still train. I still exercise, but I don't get to be at peak body fat level. And that's not to say I won't prioritize that in the future because no feeling or no decision's final. But right now, it doesn't suit my identity, my philosophy, my values around dieting. Doesn't mean I don't understand the principle. And it doesn't mean I don't catastrophize it when I have a pizza or a few beers. I just don't let that decision roll into more. And I'm trying to use this anecdote to encourage people to create their own philosophy around the principle. You don't get to decide the principle. You want to try and test gravity? Go nuts. I don't recommend it. But you can bungee jump or you can lie on the floor and everything in between. It's up to you. That's kind of the way I see it.
I love that line. One thing that I've kind of been thinking about earlier that I've been trying to communicate with some people, like dieting is like a skill, like it's a useful skill to have in order to, you know, I want to hit peak body composition, I'm going to diet until I get there, and then you reverse back out to the point where your body fat's a bit higher, but you have a bit more of a balance in life. And I think that's a useful approach as opposed to the mindset of a diet is this thing that I follow until I hit this end goal, and then I just go back eating the way I want. I'm like, no, if you look at it more like a skill that you acquire, it's like, you know, you're learning Spanish. Like, it's like speaking Spanish. It's like you use it as you need to. You're speaking to Spanish people, you use your language. You use that skill that you've acquired. And then when you're talking to me or other people, you're back doing English, your normal life. And I think approaching nutrition like that can be a little bit more helpful. And I love that line, Paul, anticipation is better than the actual thing, and the perception around food. I think that is such a philosophy. I connected with that in more ways than you know, just not with nutrition. Like the anticipation, I'm like, the thought of something always is better than the actual thing. But there's definitely with food a point of diminishing returns, like where you end up, you know, the first chocolate bar was amazing. The second one, yeah, it wasn't so bad. The third one, then you feel a bit sick, and then you eat four or five more and you're actually physically sick. So it's like, you've not only have you gone massively over on your calories, now you feel sick. So it's like finding that sweet spot. You mentioned intuitive eating there as well, and kind of tuning in with being more mindful of their food and what they're eating. How do you, or what do you recommend people do in order to become a little bit more intuitive with their, I won't say with their hunger, to eat a little bit more intuitively? Somebody that's listening to this podcast is like, yeah, I like what Paul said there. That's something I'm going to try and apply. What would be your kind of first step or advice that you would offer that person that's looking to just eat more intuitively?
This, by the kind of the definition of, say, scientific literature, is something I definitely don't feel like an expert on by any means. What I do find useful, though, is within the context of one-to-one client conversations, and the ethics of first do no harm, you know, in my own personal study around it, I feel very comfortable to talk to people around it in a personal sense because context gets lost. I remember one time I said on my own podcast, I said, choose a behavior, choose a consequence. And I remember somebody messaged me very upset, saying that something to the effect I said, you need to accept the consequences of your actions, but it was taken in a very, not the way I intended. And because of that, I feel the intuitive eating kind of thing, or not intuitive eating, but the actual paying more attention to your own hunger, to your own intuitive signals, I do think that's safer in the context of a one-to-one conversation. I don't even think you can put that into a one-fits-all kind of thing because it depends where you are in your journey. I've had clients this week tell me that this is the first week of their life they've allowed themselves to honor and obey a hunger cue, a hunger signal. I've had clients tell me that this is the first time in their life they've not been afraid to be a little bit hungry, tolerably hungry. I had a client last Christmas tell me it was the first Christmas that she was off the diet bandwagon, and the actions weren't actually that different. She was just a bit more content about making decisions around, you know, you probably are going to gain a pound or two, but you're probably going to drop it again shortly after Christmas if you go back to normal. So at the risk of offering a very nondescript, non-answer, I think if you haven't learned how to honor your own hunger or your own intuitive hunger yet, I think it is a skill you can get better at by just practicing mindfulness around food, how you feel, not eating to being stuffed, etc. But generally, it's something that I find very difficult to discuss outside of the context of a one-to-one conversation because I just don't feel fully qualified on that yet.
I'm going to ask you another question that you're probably not going to feel fully qualified on, but I'm curious more of your opinion, to preface it with your opinion and experience with the amount of people you've worked with versus this isn't your specific area. Like, I'm going to ask you a question now about kind of guilt and shame around food. And, you know, you're not a psychologist. You're not trained in anything along those lines. You're a nutritionist, personal trainer, what I consider an expert in human behavior around food. But from your experience and your opinion, why do you think people have guilt or shame around food?
That's a very interesting question. What I will say is I do think the diet industry is, you know, when people understand the principle, they don't need to buy diets and buy supplements anymore. So I do think there's this attempt by the mainstream diet industry to keep us away from the principle. Essentially, when you understand the principle, you don't need anyone anymore. You know, you and I both need to understand the principle of money. Like, let's say, don't spend more than you earn. You and I don't really get an opinion on whether that's a good idea. It's probably a good idea. But what we do with our money is kind of individual to us. And let's say you understand that concept very well. You don't really need a financial advisor doing your finances every single day. You're probably capable of getting by. I think the diet industry is similar, but in a much more, dare I say, venomous way, because it has the power to really disrupt our emotions around food. What I tell clients is guilt and shame can't be the identity from which you make your decisions. For example, I've received messages from people who have said something to the effect of, I had a binge last night, but the scale's not up this morning. I got away with it. And I'm like, that's a very unsupportive thought process because it's away from the identity you're trying to create. That almost insinuates that you can do it again. And then if the scale did go up, then you beat yourself up. Plus, that's not how body fat's necessarily accumulated in one day, blah, blah. But that's far away from the identity you're trying to create. Similarly, people who tend to exercise just because they ate, again, you don't want your exercise identity to be on the foundation of guilt because you ate. Feeling shame around having a donut or having an extra bar of chocolate, or, you know, I shouldn't eat this or I shouldn't eat that. You know, that kind of shame around it is no identity from which to create a nutrition plan. Like, I've had clients, you know, he's been on your podcast, for example, Steve. He's received a negative comment about his weight, and he created identity change off the basis that he did no longer want to feel that kind of shame and wanted to feel empowered. So you might need a certain degree of negative emotion to fuel you. But I don't think when all or the bulk of your behaviors around guilt and shame or food, pardon, are driven by guilt and shame, I don't think you can ever have a successful life, because when do you ever get a chance to relax and switch off the mind and get that emotional connection with food, you know, savor a few beers or a donut or a pizza? I know I spend a lot of time talking about this, but I think it's such a big deal. And as someone like me who does get a very strong emotional connection in a good sense about food, you know, I travel Asia, I've done food tours where I've been to 10 restaurants in one day. I want people to be in a position to be able to say yes or no of their own accord, and not because of some toxic diet cycle that they've been sold for years by the diet industry that's only interested in receiving their cash. So why? Years of yo-yo habits perpetrated by a diet industry, but it falls up to us to escape that as individuals.
Yeah, it's something that we both try and do with our podcast, to be fair, in terms of putting out educational content around it. Which is a kind of a follow-up on that, because people that listen to this podcast, particularly long-term listeners, know my philosophy on nutrition. I've had multiple expert guests coming on talking in all different directions on different diets, different nutritional strategies, etc. Why do you think people struggle to think that because you live what you preach, in the sense that I know you work with a lot of overweight people, obese people, etc. But you live what you preach, in the sense that if I need to be a little bit leaner and I want to kind of look that photo shoot ready, I'm going to be a little bit stricter with my nutrition. But 80% of the time, you can be found in Vietnam getting, you know, going on a food tour or having a few beers or doing whatever it is you want. Why do you think, or do you think, people don't believe that it's possible to have that sort of lifestyle and still hit their goal? Or, you know, a language that you use, that I use, is, you know, hit their target self. What, you know, they're striving for an identity, you're striving for a target, a goal. What would your target self do? Do you think people struggle with the believing that it's possible? And the reason I bring that up is because when you try and instill the principles, like you've said, about calorie balance for fat loss, that if you're in a calorie deficit, you know, your body will utilize fat for fuel. Like, for 99.9% of people, of course, is going to be the outliers and the anomalies, that there's something, an issue with hormones or genetic or an underlying illness, that yeah, they might be in a deficit and they won't lose body fat. Like, it's the, but very much down to the, I put this on my Instagram yesterday, it's like, when you hear hooves, think horses, not zebras. Like, you know, there's a good chance if you're not losing fat, you're not in a calorie deficit. It's not your hormones, it's not a genetic thing, it's not an underlying issue. For the majority of people, you're just actually eating too many calories. Why do you think people don't, and this is maybe my putting my lens on it, which may not be, you may not have the same experience, but sometimes when I talk to people, they feel like it's not possible to have the chocolate bar. It's not possible to have the beers. It's not possible to have a life and hit their weight loss goal, or and hit their body compositional goal. Why do you think there's a barrier there? Or I might be completely mistaken. You may not have seen that in people. What's your experience been with that?
I don't believe challenging our deepest held thoughts is an inherent condition of the human race, my friend. And that's what I think it comes down to. I think we need people to challenge us in any context. I really do. I think it is a case of that kind of black and white absolutist mindset. But I know my life has been inherently richer since I've had lived at Orla, and she's challenged a lot of what I've thought in a very healthy manner. And I think that can be partially summed up in that, because we all have blind spots. I remember being under the illusion I was some logical, rational thinker. And I think now, as I find more and more blind spots in my personality and in my character, I'm realizing the depths of which it is easy to fool ourselves. And isn't it the old Feynman quote? I think you say it a lot. Don't fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. And I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, it's so true, in the sense that the more, one of the advantages of this podcast, of, you know, I know you're a big reader now as well, something you've switched over to. You're
I'm
doing pretty good though. You're doing pretty good. And just to give a little bit of context, Paulie gave me a shout out on his podcast. I'm the first full physical book that he's ever read, because he's an audiobook guy. So I'm like, yep, I've beaten the Fernando Torres autobiography on that one, which I have I bring up every time books come up, because I'm very proud of that.
No better man to break my book virginity.
That's it. Pop the cherry, rewire your mindset. But you mentioned Orla there, and we've had this conversation. We're very fortunate with our private conversations, our public conversations, that between our friendship, your relationship with Orla, other mutual friends we have, and some friends that aren't mutual in terms of our inner circle and people that are close to us. Do you think that is key for questioning those belief systems? Or do you think that if you don't have those people around you, you can get it from podcasts, you can get it from books, or is obviously the combination of both going to be key? What's your kind of thoughts on that for people listening?
I think you can absolutely get it from anywhere. I think you just have to be open. I personally believe you just have to be open to having your best held beliefs challenged. It's actually one of the things I love about my Spanish lessons. We talk about a lot of things, and me and my Spanish teacher don't share many common opinions on, for example, much of society. Now, I'm not overly opinionated, but I would have opinions, and she doesn't share them. And I come away from my Spanish lesson, hopefully a little bit more intelligent with the Spanish language, but also thinking, okay, somebody who I trust and like has challenged my worldview. And I think it's the Ray Dalio principle of find the people that you've put faith in the most, who don't think like you, and listen to them. And I think there's so much value in doing that. And it goes with your deepest loved beliefs, or even your deepest held beliefs, because I just don't believe anything's inherently true or untrue or good or bad anymore. I just think the idea that there's such an infinite amount of facts and an infinite amount of wisdom in the world to learn, and the idea that you would have just learned 6 randomly when you were 7 and 19, and now you understand them back to front and sideways because someone told you. When you start to think of it like that, it just makes you a little bit less certain what you've been led to believe. So I think if you hold an open mind to everything and realizing that you actually probably aren't necessarily correct in any of your deepest loved beliefs, I think it's a very liberating feeling. It goes back to what I said at the start about the black and white worldview really supporting how I wanted to see the world. I didn't think black and white because I was some smart dude. It supported what I wanted to think. It bet the hell out of the time of needing to think for myself and discover the context of the answer and where it may or may not apply. And to not bore people and to get back a bit simple. I've heard many different analogies from many smart people. I know you use very simple analogies too, but I have said it to clients in the past, what's your opinion of a knife? If you ask a stab victim versus someone who had toast for breakfast, it's two very different experiences of knife. Yeah. So nothing is inherently good nor bad. It's the context in which the tool is used. It's the context in which the thought process is used. And again, I talk to clients about many things and what quantifies kind of a fuck it button moment or, going into fuck it mode. And I'm like, I don't know, because if you have a pizza and that makes you feel dreadful versus someone who has it in a social setting in an Italian in a cozy restaurant and they feel great, same calories, same food, different perception. So I think you have to be open to having your perception challenged. And I really do believe if you're the kind of person that believes we can change and we can form the identity of what we like, not who we are, I really do think you can let go of anything in search of a much better quality of thought process. And life is only our thoughts, isn't it? That old Buddha wisdom. I'm not stating anything new.
Yeah, it's so we paint the world with our thoughts. I think that is one of the lines that always took out to me, and I know it was Will Smith quoting Buddha, but it's from Will Smith I heard it, is that the he who says he's right and he who says he's wrong are both usually right. It doesn't matter what you tell yourself, that becomes your truth, that becomes your identity, that becomes who you are. And it's funny when you talk about the black and white thinking, I always think myself someone that is very similar to you in the sense that I have a history of black and white, because black and white is way more comforting. I'm way more comfortable somebody being like, yes, do this, no, don't do that, yes, this is black, no, that is white, whereas most of the things are in the gray. Black and white is a comfort blanket, when you were a fucking kid when you had a blankie or something, a toy that you had. Black and white thinking is a comfort blanket. It's very comfortable to think I'm right or that's wrong, as opposed to, ooh, maybe that thought isn't helping me or serving me anymore. And it's really uncomfortable to do that reflection on whatever that is, whether that's a dietary thing, whether that's a relationship thing, whether that's a job security thing, whether that's a financial or a money thing. That's a really uncomfortable question to ask yourself. It's like, oh, what, the purple polar bear that we've talked about before. It's like, why did somebody comment and now I feel like I need to defend it? Why did somebody question me on this thing and now I feel I need to attack them? I'm like, will you check in with that? I'm like, because there's a lot of gold. It's the Jungian philosophy that what you most need is where you least want to look. And generally when you pull on that string, it can disconnect you from that black and white thinking. And I think that's a really useful aspect to apply to. Again, I'm biased as somebody that has gone from one way to the other and has a much more positive life now and is able to paint the world in a much more positive way because of it. I think it's a very, very supportive belief, or a very, very supportive idea, to rephrase, that is worth adopting for a lot of people.
Definitely. And you said there about reflecting, something I'm reflecting on this very second. In Spanish, my Spanish teacher will often ask me questions, and then I will go on this massive tangent in broken Spanish. And I'll go, what was the question? That's a long answer. What am I even talking about? And now I'm on a podcast, and now I'm reflecting, and I'm like, God, Brian's asking questions, and now I'm going on these tangents, and these are very long answers, and what the hell am I doing? So I'm having one of those crisis conundrums on air right now, just so you know.
Well, I'll pull it back. Paul, you were the king of talking. I can ask you a question on nearly anything, and you can always give me let me rephrase. To be fair, one of the things I love most about you is if you do have an opinion or a thought on it, you can share it in a very articulated way, but you're also the first person that's like, yeah, I have no opinion on that, I haven't thought about that, I don't know. It's like, all right, cool, yeah. Next question.
But, you can look very, you know, you can look, it's wisdom that I picked up from somewhere else. There was some article I read, you know, maybe it's Buddha wisdom, you know, it is better to keep your mouth shut and be thought of as the fool than to open it and confirm it. But it's a bit uncomfortable at the start. You know, when you're in a conversation with people, particularly at a bar, and you're with three or four people who are a little bit louder, a little bit more opinionated than you, and you know when someone says something that's so not true, and you just want to jump in and be like, it's not that you're wrong, because my ego is obviously massaging myself if I'm telling you you're wrong. It's just, it's a very strong opinion. And sometimes you just have to sit there quietly and be thought of as the fool. It's a little bit uncomfortable moment to moment, but it's a skill I'm working on.
How do you, just out of curiosity on my side, because that's something I've also been thinking about. I've got better with this over the years, because there was a time, you know, we're sprouting quotes now, but I'm a quote person. People listen to this podcast for a long time know that's my superpower. I can't fucking fly, and I wouldn't be able to like crash through a building, but I'd be able to retain all the quotes in the world. I'm like, that's the fucking superpower I'd have. But one that I always think is the Newton quote, that tact is the ability to make a point without making an enemy. And I've got better with that over the years. But when you're in that situation of a bar, and there's people listening to this podcast who will have this around nutrition or around training, where people will say something and it's clearly not correct, and you're like, that's definitely not right, and your ego side wants to jump straight in and be like, oh no, you know, as you said, massage your own ego. How do you find, or what do you do, or what's your kind of inner dialogue for stopping yourself from jumping across and massaging your own ego and telling somebody that they're wrong? Because I know how good that can feel, like, because you're getting that fucking endorphin hit, like, you're like, I'm right, you know, you have a piece of information that it's like you can share across. How do you stop yourself doing that? Or do you have any kind of strategy for, because that's a very tempting thing, and I'm just, for my own selfishness, I'm curious, because it's a nice little tool I'd like to have in my arsenal. What do you do in those situations?
I think when you reflect on why you're doing it, you do realize that there is that element of wanting to be seen to be correct. I think you also need to ask yourself, why are you even being bothered? It's like one opinion expressed in one moment of time. And everybody sees the world, you know, through their experience, through their worldview, etc. And most of us, especially I assume the people you're hanging out with, I know the people I'm hanging out with the same, are trying to do a little bit of good in the world, and definitely don't mean any harm. But I just, self-reflection, why am I doing it? Almost always, if I take a bit of time and think about why I'm doing anything, unless it's just blatantly incorrect and I want to contribute because it would make the conversation a bit better, it's just coming from a place of ego. Nobody cares. Sometimes you just have to keep your mouth shut and just get on with it. That's honestly as simple as it gets for me. What about you?
Yeah, I'm not as good at it as you. It depends on what the conversation is. I'm similar to you in the sense that if I don't have an opinion on something, like I'm the first one to be like, I have no opinion on politics. Like, there's no point even trying to engage me in a conversation or fight me on a political belief. I'm like, yeah, I don't care. Like, I just don't care. I was like, I have no opinion. Like, you know, Donald Trump's ruining the world. I'm like, oh, cool. I don't know him. My world's great. I'm like, I was like, he's not ruining my world. Like, so there are things that I don't engage on. But sometimes, again, it's a feedback for me. If I feel that I need to contribute and give my two cents and jump in, I normally have to ask, oh, why do I feel insecure in this area? For me, it's normally down to a place of insecurity. If I feel I need to put my idea or contribute to a conversation because somebody else is wrong and I have a better opinion, or quote unquote, what I think my ego says is a better opinion, I tend to feel like, oh shit, I'm obviously not feeling very secure in this topic, and I need to, or this room, or around these people. You know, I've done that a few times in the past where we've had conversations off air, when I'd be chatting to people that were, you know, pretty big guests on the podcast, or I'd be meeting somebody for a collaboration, and I would feel the need to, you know, tell them how many followers I had or tell them how much money I had. And I remember it happened a couple of times in a row in 2016, 2017, 2018. And, you know, when I first started doing like really, really well kind of financially, and my growing and the social media was growing, and I felt it happened a couple of the times. I'm like, oh, you're not very secure. I'm like, why the fuck? I'm like, you haven't done this with anybody else except for these people who are making you feel insecure. And that came down to an issue with me. I'm like, right, I'm clearly not as secure internally as I thought I was. So I had to do reflection on that. And now it's not something I do anymore. But, you know, I don't think there's any problem making mistakes. It's like, just don't make the same mistakes over and over again. Like, if you have an action or you say something that's kind of out of order with your target self, it's like, okay, reflect on that and don't make the same mistake again. I think that can be a useful, again, I don't know how helpful that is, but that's kind of has been my journey and my process with it over the last few years.
Have you ever been at a discussion or at a table where somebody says something about a topic you'd be quite well informed in, and it is so away from the truth that you just can't help but think, what? For example, I went home for my sister's wedding, and my aunt looked at my sister who was eating sweet potato chips, and she was like, oh, they're not even fattening. And, you know, the sentence made no sense because, you know, what does that even mean? And I was just kind of thinking, I hope I'm never that to somebody else who understands the topic better than me. I hope I never chip in about conversations about politics or astrophysics or social things where somebody who actually understands the theme is just thinking, what are you talking about, you moron?
It's so true. That's a very difficult social scenario to navigate through as well. I've found that if it's something that, because something else has happened, I've had very similar conversations. Sometimes I just don't even contribute. I'm like, okay, I'm not even getting into this. I'm like, where the fuck do you start? It's like, you know, I know it's the how to eat an elephant bite by bite, but I'm like, I ain't fucking going after this one. Like, I'm not even attempting to deconstruct this belief system that somebody else holds. But sometimes though, it can be useful. What I found, one of the old methods we used to use when I was teaching, a little bit more with the older kids, but it was kind of I'm sure you're familiar. Are you maybe not. The Socratic method of asking questions to get the person to come to the point so that you don't actually have to lead them there. Are you familiar with that terminology in terms of the teaching method?
I, believe it or not, wasn't familiar with the name. But
you do this with your clients. I've heard you do this with your clients.
Yeah, the principle is something I'd be familiar with. You know, why, for example, just not to interrupt you, but brilliant example recently, somebody told me when I was drinking a Diet Coke that it was more fattening than regular Coke, which again makes no sense compared, like, fattening in what context, you know, how does that work? And I just literally went, oh, in what context? They're like, oh, well, the insulin spikes from an aspartame raise, which apparently isn't even true. And I said, and what does that do? And the blank look that came across their face, you know. It's just, you know, let me enjoy my Diet Coke. I'm lucky I understand this shit, but you could fuck someone's relationship up with the one thing they actually like that keeps them adhering to their diet.
That's why I think I love your, you know, the coaching method you do. I do something very similar in my programs. And I know there's been other coaches. David Young's been on this podcast, who's very, very good with this as well. Getting people to question why and understanding that where the information is coming from is important. And at the part of your journey, this is something that I've kind of forgotten about, that I've rechecked back in with a couple of recent conversations I've had, that I forget that after a certain point, you have so much information and knowledge that you just brush off stupid shit. So for example, Paul, I think you're probably the same as me. Like, somebody makes a comment like that about Diet Coke, you're like, okay, what's the context? But that to somebody else is enough to completely derail them. Like, if you're relatively new on your journey, that's why it's so hard. You know, that language I use is like, going from 0 to 1 is considerably harder than going from 1 to 10. And that means that when you start a diet first, or you start a weight loss journey first, or you start a nutritional plan first, it's way more difficult in the beginning because you don't have all the context. You don't know what's right and wrong. Like, it's the same as, you know, you mentioned astrophysics earlier. Like, somebody can tell me something about the stars and I'm like, oh yeah? I'm like, oh yeah, maybe. Like, it could be true. Like, I don't know. Like, you know, because you don't have the context. And I think it's very important to have the self-awareness at where are you on your journey right now? Because if you're at the beginning going from 0 to 1, where you don't really understand nutrition that much, you don't really understand calorie balance, it's like, right, if you're working with Paul, listen to Paul. If you're working with me, listen to me. If you're working with another coach, nutritionist or trainer, listen to them. That's what you're paying them for. Like, that's their expertise, that's their job. And you nearly need to block out the noise from everybody else, because people, like, that's the thing with opinions. Like, everybody has an opinion. Like, you know, we joke all the time about Jane down the street about the Special K diet. It's like, you know, you should go on the Special K diet. It's like, well,
Jane's fucking 3 stone overweight. I'm like, why are you taking nutrition advice from Jane? I'm like, she's not the person to take dietary advice from. She might be the most amazing person in the world. She might be the best friend, gives the best advice on relationship or money or business or whatever. But fuck, she's 3 stone overweight. Like, you shouldn't be taking dietary advice from her. How do you get people to, the people you work with, what's your approach for getting them to, for the lack of a better term, tune out the noise and focus on the signal?
Well, you're searching for context is a very big one. I do like the idea that I think when you understand the principles, I think you become bullshit proof. There's, unless I sought nutrition advice now from someone I trust, respected, and wanted the input, it'd be very hard to get me to not eat the way I do. I really like how I do. So that's what I'm trying to do with everybody. One thing I've heard you say a few times is don't take advice from someone you wouldn't trade positions with. I want to make a little spin on that and say, don't be too quick to accept criticism of somebody you wouldn't take advice from. And I'm not saying that as a kind of a mindset meditation to make you confident. I'm actually saying that really practical, as a very practical principle for life. It's very unlikely you or I or anyone is going to be very well educated at more than a very small handful of things. And I think it's a very, 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 very practical skill to know who to take advice from and who not to. And by that proxy, who to take criticism or constructive input from and who not to. For example, I'm not going under any circumstances to take advice from you on how to paint the Sistine Chapel, because I don't trust you know enough about how. Business, nutrition, personal training, fantastic. Great. You have a better chance on that one. The art side of things from the Renaissance, not so much. Similar to many other things, there's very few people who are actually technically qualified to offer advice on many things. And I think generally the mark of a well-educated mind is they're very informed on a topic. They know the context in which information may or may not apply. And they're very self-aware as to when is a good time to offer the advice in itself. Because just because you know doesn't mean it's good for the recipient at that moment in time. So I think it's a really good meditation to practice in life, if that's the right term, to think daily. You know, today, you know, the old, I don't know who says these things, but I picked them up. Today I will encounter rude, arrogant, ignorant people who are going to offer me bad manners and bad energy and unsolicited advice. And I think it's a really practical skill to get almost so non-emotional in your decision that you know exactly who to take advice from and in what context. I'm never going to debate a nutritional scientist ever. I know who I can help. I know who I can't. But somebody with 7 years of hardcore research will school me. I study it in my spare time. I love what I do. I'm very passionate, but I'm very self-aware as to who I cannot help. And I'm not in a laboratory doing experiments. Somebody in the research will know it before I do. I study the researchers. I'm never going to study an economist. You can tell me about the inflation and all that stuff, and you're probably right. And even if you're not, I don't know. So I need to seek out the advice myself. So I'm trying to make people very aware on, it's not so much the advice to take, it's the context and the person and the emotional intelligence whom, because not everybody, like some people will actually kind of almost go in argumentative to give you advice and may not actually have the emotional intelligence and the capability to deal with the discourse that comes from having advice rejected. And that's a surefire sign for me that probably not worth listening to. So one of the most useful principles, and I'm telling my clients this and I'm practicing this daily myself, is, again, don't accept constructive input or from somebody you wouldn't necessarily take advice from, because I think it's a really useful principle and strategy to improve in areas of life that are actually beneficial.
That reminds me of a recent conversation I had with my mum and my dad. I don't talk about dad that much on the podcast, but I was having a conversation about a couple of things that were happening kind of over COVID in terms of financial stuff, investments, etc. And I remember my mum told me that, you know, he was offering me advice. And my dad is very intelligent when it comes to investments and finances and things like that. He's very, very tuned into that in terms of it's his interest, and he has years of experience with it. And I remember he was offering me advice on something, and my mum had to tell me, she was like, he thinks you're not listening to him. And I'm like, no, I am listening to him. I'm just choosing not to take his advice because I don't think it's applicable to me. I'm like, there's a big difference there. And yeah. I had the conversation with him. He's like, you're not fucking listening to me anyway. I'm like, no. I was like, there's a difference. I said, I am listening. I'm just choosing that this advice isn't applicable to me. I'm like, I am listening because I value your opinion, because I think you're smart in this particular area. And I think when you understand and get better with where the advice is coming from and then choosing to accept or reject it. I think that's a very, very useful approach to lots of conversations as well, because that's when you kind of start to see the context. And it's not that you're tuning everybody out necessarily, it's that you're going to the right people to seek advice. And then based on how confident you are and what it is that they offer you, you're choosing to accept or reject it. What are your kind of thoughts on that in terms of, do you think that's useful for people, or do you have a completely different approach to that?
No, I would absolutely agree. I would be particular about who I offer advice to myself, in the sense that, you know, to play devil's advocate on your story, which is 100% applicable, I'm going to flip it back and think of times I've often given advice that was incorrect. For example, my sister is a really smart, kind, caring human. She's one of a kind, a very lucky brother. Love her dearly. She's actually having a baby in 2 weeks and I won't be home to see it, which is kind of sad. But I made my bed by staying in Vietnam because it's better for my mental health because of the sun, blah, blah, blah. That's neither here nor there. My sister wanted to leave her job, the counseling. She wanted to get a different job years back. And I told her she should start her own business. You know, I had seen a little bit of success through Facebook and Instagram, you know, building clients and yada, yada, yada. So I started telling her, do it, do it, do it, do it. So kind of against her better judgment, she did it. After about 2 days, she was just riddled with anxiety, trying to balance all these things, career change, content. So she posted her first piece of content and she was like, oh, it got like, you know, 7 likes and 3 comments. This is great. What next? And I went, great, post more. And she was like, what? And I was like, post more now, write posts. And she was like, I'm tired. And I was just kind of very like, I know, but you know, you got to build up your business. And within 5 days, she had been like, this is not for me. What the hell? And if I had removed myself from, again, that black and white mindset, this is what, 4 years ago at this stage, that not everybody wants to be a bloody entrepreneur, I would have seen that my sister is not an entrepreneur. She's never once given the sign she's an entrepreneur. She values stability. She loves 9 to 5. She takes weekends off. She's quite a shy girl. Nothing about that suggests social media personality. And I give dreadful advice. She still jokes about it and thanks me because I meant well from the heart, but it was dreadful advice. So sometimes the advice can be good for the wrong person. Sometimes it can be from a good place, but it can be ignorant and out of context. And sometimes it's just plain incorrect. So I try and monitor my own role in these things now and try to be very selective of what I speak, but I'm definitely selective on what I take as well. Very observant these days. At least I like to think I am.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's something that I try and do with people in that when I'm doing business work with people, business coaching, etc., is that to not be that, you know, to the man with the hammer, the whole world looks like a nail, that someone that's quite extroverted or someone that's a good writer, I'm like, okay, yeah, you should be doing loads of social media and you should be writing loads. So I'm like, you're good at that. That's clearly what you're going to excel in. Whereas somebody that's the opposite is like, well, you take a different strategy, then you're going to take a more introverted approach to building your business or whatever the context is. You mentioned the value there and the security for your sister. What do you value?
Happiness, freedom, time, love. They're the things that come to mind straight away. I'm a little bit hesitant about saying this on air because it might come across a tiny bit pretentious, but the two words I repeat to myself every single day now are rich and anonymous. Rich and anonymous, rich and anonymous. They're the two words, and they're kind of two values I'm aspiring to. And it's funny because the 4-hour work week talked about this and I got nothing from the 4-hour work week. And I can attest it was because I hang out with you so much. You know, his concept of living like the new rich.
Yeah.
You need in my opinion, if you can live below your means, you need a staggeringly low amount of money if you have your values lined up correctly to live a really good life. And then everything else is a bonus. And I heard Naval say this years back that most people who live below their means are enjoying a freedom that people upgrading their lives will never comprehend. And nothing ever landed with me more, man. And I'm not a very lavish guy anyway, but I did go on this very clear value change. I got rid of a lot of my stuff, adopted a lot of minimalist qualities. I don't own much now. I own everything I own can be in a suitcase. So if I want to leave Vietnam, I can go. My day is what I want right now. It's what I want. So it is definitely happiness, freedom, time, love. And then the two words I repeat to myself are rich and anonymous, but I'm not talking conquer the world and have obscene amounts of money rich. It's more rich in love, rich in character, rich in finance, rich in spirit, just rich in soul. Very, very, very short life here on earth. And I don't really want to waste it with the silly little things that don't bring me any value day to day. I just want, pardon the cheesiness here, but I just want days filled with joy and contentment and peace and love and ambition and drive and whatever emotion I'm feeling at a given day to just accept it and sit with it and enjoy it and appreciate it and that's kind of what I value right now. Have your values, because I haven't talked to you about this in a long time, have your values adjusted or changed? Because I haven't physically seen you in nearly a year. Can you believe that it has nearly been a year since you were here?
Jesus, it was a year when I went out to Vietnam to visit you.
Yeah,
it was. Fuck yeah, it was October, wasn't it? October, November, yeah. Around that time.
Yeah.
My goodness. It's not that I've changed my values. It's just that I've gotten a little bit more aware of, they become clearer. So one of the values that I've been seeking for fucking years is just peace. Like, you know, as somebody that has had kind of a history of anxiety and that kind of 800-pound gorilla in the room, and thankfully, over the last few years, it started kind of moving out closer to home. So, like, for what I do in terms of my internal dialogue for people listening is I do the, you know, what, why, where, like, and who. I'm like, what am I doing in terms of my job? Where am I in terms of location? Who am I around? And why am I doing it? I'm like, if I can answer those four questions, it tends to kind of give me a little bit more peace. And there was a time when them answers or those questions weren't very clear. So like the first step of my journey was moving out closer to home. So I live about 10 minutes away from my mum and dad's house now, which was kind of my first step on that journey. I'm like, okay, I've got the location right. I'm where I need to be. What I'm doing was all has been right for years. Like when I left my teaching job and started my own business in fitness, I'm like, okay, my ladder's up against the right wall. I was like, I absolutely love what I'm doing. I know why I'm doing it. You know, my daughter, my internal drive, all of those things. And one thing I struggle with was when you left, you know, we've talked about this briefly. One thing I struggled when you left was the who. Because I'm like, okay, well, my best friend is gone now. I'm like, he's the other side of the world. And like, we can talk and we connect. But I'm like, it's still not the same. You know, and I've told you off air multiple times how much I miss you that you're away. And that's something I've kind of had to come to peace with. And I've been very lucky with some of the people who I've brought into my life in the last 18 months who enrich me, who make me feel content, who make me feel peace. And that's, in terms of value, I was just looking at different ways to find the same thing. Like I'm in a very fortunate position where like I don't struggle with ambition. Like they're not things I have an issue with. Like I have to fucking manage my ambition. Like to the point, like I have to do a visualization process with them. Have you read anything by Felix Dennis? I can't remember the business he had, but he's a billionaire. How to Get Rich is his book. Terrible title, similar to the 4-Hour Workweek, but it's a fantastic read. Are you familiar with Felix Dennis's work?
Not at all, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so he's, I don't remember if you ever remember the line I told you. He's got a line in that book I'm going to say it on the podcast. It's the, he's a billionaire and one of his financial advice was, if you can fly it, float it, or fuck it, you should rent it. And I always remember that line from the book. I'm like, that tells you everything you need to know about his personality. But in one of his books, there's something that actually did really serve me was he talks about the tiger of ambition, that like, tiger's a great thing. He's like, if you have a pet tiger, it's a fantastic thing to have. But like, if you don't control your tiger, it's going to fucking bite the face of you. And that's how I think about ambition. And for me, they kind of are two sides of the same coin, that sometimes I can become so ambitious with what I'm doing, so focused and desired on what I'm doing and channeled on what I'm doing, that I can completely lose sense of peace. It's the tiger biting my face. And, you know, I've lived my life by the, you know, when you're reaching for the moons, don't forget the flowers at your feet, in terms of you can have it all. Just be conscious of it and be mindful of it. So yeah, in terms of my value, it's been that one, just because I have a very fortunate life with what I do, the people that are around me, you know, virtually in the case of you and physically in the case of other people. But I think it's a very checking in with your values and what, because if you don't do that, and I was worse than you, Paul, on this one. Like I definitely fell into the social construct of what values were: the new car, nice clothes, great, you know, good physique, you know, external success, making money, all these things. And for me, I fell into that kind of social construct on, this is what I think is valuable. Junk values is what I called them in my last book. I'm like, the junk values, as opposed to, all right, fuck, what are my true values? I'm like, what do I really value? I'm like, I value quality time with people, the people that I love. I value my peace of mind. I value security, you know, financial security and not having to worry, like them, you know, the FU money. Like I love having FU money. That one of the reasons why I don't have to promote stupid fucking teas is because I can tell someone to go fuck themselves. I'm like, I'm not promoting that. I'm like, get the fuck away from me with your skinny tea. Like, and I think that FU money is something that I value, and that's my version of security. And I think asking that question is really important, because it does get clearer. As somebody that
started this journey years ago and was very foggy. Like it was literally trying to navigate through a foggy forest. It gets significantly clearer if you stay on that path and keep asking the right questions and listening to the podcast and reading the books and being around the right people who challenge your belief systems. I think it's one of, for me, it's life-changing. It's literally the Pandora's box. Like you can never go back to not working towards whatever your values are once you start doing it, because you've seen what it's like on the other side of the junk values, and you're like, it's the analogy of ladder up against the wrong wall, that you get to the top of the ladder and you're like, oh my God, I'm against the wrong fucking wall, and you've spent all this time, energy and effort, and it's a horrible feeling, it's a very hollow feeling. So I think it's a useful thing. Sorry, I've taken over that complete conversation now, but it's a very, very useful question to ask in terms of what is that you value.
Yeah, no, not at all, dude. It's quite the contrast. I'd say our journeys have been polar opposites. I've never really struggled much on the junk values other than the illusion that the physique would bring me happiness, which didn't turn out. And I have a feeling a lot of people who perhaps haven't achieved their transformation physique won't believe that, but it's true. I do feel very lucky. I've never really had to struggle with that kind of sense of peace, to tell you the truth. Again, I was hesitant about saying this on air, but when I think of people I admire, they tell their story proudly. About 4 years ago, when I left Ladbrokes to start my business, I wasn't so sure I could make it. I took a €3,000 loan off my sister. She just gave it to me. I wanted to do something. I didn't have the money for it. I thought it would feed well into the business. I'd mentioned to my sister, and she offered me the money. I didn't even ask for it. And I'll never forget what she said. She said, "I have no doubt I will get this money back plus some." She goes, "You have the hardest part figured out. You're the most self-assured, happy-go-lucky, content character I've ever met. That's the hard part figured out. You'll figure the money part out." And I'll never forget that level of self-belief that put in me. Such a nice thing to be told when you kind of have no proof that you're not a businessman, you have no clients, you have no money. I knew I was going to be working with you, obviously, but still, when you can't see the future, it's still quite a daunting position. So to have that kind of, to have that kind of belief put in you from someone, and to be reminded that your values are nice and endearing by somebody you admire, is kind of a cool thing too. So I never massively struggled with junk values other than the illusion of the physique. And I'm very lucky. I feel very fortunate that after the physique thing, and I did a whole scale reevaluation of life, I was still working in Ladbrokes, which I didn't particularly fulfill me, and kind of chasing the wrong things. You talk about the ladder and the wrong wall. Very grateful that I took a little bit of time, reevaluated what I want from life, and reevaluated my relationship with time, because I say I don't struggle with ambition, but I would actually consider myself now to be a very ambitious person. But I'm just very aware I'll want to play the game at 41 in 11 years' time, at 53 in 23 years' time. So I'm not under any illusion that this game just ends when I hit a certain number. I don't think it does. And I'm just looking for those moments in the day where I can find tranquility and happiness in the moments that I know other people are taking for granted. And it's this kind of cruel dichotomy in a sense, because you're always trading the present for the future. Like you're trying to walk down the street and you're ignoring these hundreds and thousands of wonderful sensations, like the wind in your face and hair and birds in the sky and blue and the sunshine and all these wonderful things, because you're thinking about what you're going to have for dinner. Did I lock the door? You're always kind of trading the present for these silly moments that actually aren't in the present. But honestly, man, again, at the risk of sounding super cheesy, you could ask Orla or my sister or my family, I just believe life is in the here and now. No matter how much we try and fight it, I just believe if we can find a little bit more peace and happiness in the here and now, because it's ultimately all we have. I really do believe that.
One of the reasons I think we're so connected and get so much from our friendship, and a lot of people have commented externally on this actually through my DMs, that they're like, you're so different, but yet you can see why you two connect the way you do. And I've heard that from so many people who just are kind of flies on the wall for the podcast.
Happened today. One of my clients texted me that exact line today. I swear to God.
Why do you think it is? I have my thoughts, but why do you think it is? Why do you think it comes across? Because it's when I say it comes across that way, I'm like, the reason I bring it up is because that's exactly it. It's so true. Why do you think that is?
I just think it comes down to, there's respect. There's a mutual respect. There's a desire to come to an amicable conclusion, but there's a chronic challenging of beliefs. Do you remember when me, you and Tricia Lewis met for coffee just before Christmas when I came home, and you said something to me that was quote unquote harsh, and that was normal to me, like I didn't give a shit. But Tricia kind of gave me this kind of double-eyed look to see how I'd react. And I was like, oh, Brian's right. fuck. And Tracy was like, Jesus, lads, you talk to each other fairly hard. And I remember thinking, this is my prerequisite for a good friendship. I don't want to be told I'm beautiful and pretty. It would be lovely if he told me I'm handsome, but that's not what I'm looking for in a friendship. I need to be told the bitter truth when it's coming from the right place. I just think it's a willing to challenge each other's beliefs, but also build each other up. We said this before, you should be excited to see your friends. You should be very excited to see your friends. And your friends should point out good things about you too. And even if they, like, you've pointed out a million times, write more, write more, write more. You're good at writing. And I'm like, okay, Brian, relax. But I'm not sure I'd be able to write confidently for my Medium articles if I didn't have you in order saying, write more. You're good at it. So I think it's the building up at appropriate times, but never at the expense of truth. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I remember that conversation in Temple in Galway with Tricia, because she literally looked at me like, oh my God, Paul's going to punch you. And I was like, and you were like, oh yeah, you sat with it and you're like, hey, fuck, you're right.
Do you remember what you said?
No, I can't remember what the conversation was.
She was talking about her book and you were talking about your book. And then she looked at me and said, what about your book? And you went, yeah, Paul, it's time to shit or get off the pot.
And that does sound like something I'd say, yeah.
And I went, yeah, you're right, fuck. And then that's when she kind of went, oh, Paul's not going to deck Brian. He's going to just accept this constructive criticism. And I was like, but he's right. Like, there's no two ways about it here. I've been talking about it for bloody 18 months and I haven't done a thing.
Yeah, it's, and again, both of us have been very lucky that Trish has kind of came into our lives and we've been able to meet and chat multiple, like I chat to Trish nearly every week now. She's just such an incredible person. The last thing I want to touch on before we finish up today's podcast, because we could literally do 3 hours if we wanted, which we might do at some stage. Sometimes down the line, we'll do like an extra long one. You talked about the book there. And I'm not going to get too much into the book because it's still kind of in early days in terms of what you're doing. But one thing I did want to pause you on, because we were talking very briefly before we went on air, and about the book, because I generally asked in conversation, you know, how's the book coming along? You were telling me. And you mentioned, and I wrote down the exact words you said, was, I'm ready for it to be rejected now. And that without context, that's going to sound like a funny line. But I know exactly what you meant when you said it. Can you expand on that? Just expand on that. I'll let you talk to that.
Yeah, no, I will. I'll just be straight about it entirely. I wasn't going to say anything because I've talked before and not followed through on the book. So I started writing on Sunday. And would you believe, on Sunday I woke up at 3 a.m. and I couldn't sleep. So I got up and I just started writing my book, which sounds nuts because I've been trying to do it for 2 years. And I wrote about 6,000 words and I really didn't think it was dreadful. So then I decided to get up at 4 a.m. on the next night and I wrote another chapter and I was thinking, okay, not terrible. You're not that stupid. Okay. And then I got up again around 4-ish. I take a PT 3 times a week at 6 a.m. here. So I got up at 4 again, did an hour and a half of writing before my PT session. And I read back after the PT session as if I didn't write it. And I remember thinking, this would have helped me at 16. I needed this book at 16 or 20 or 23 for me personally. So then I read it from what I've written so far. It took about an hour to read the whole thing so far. And I thought, okay, I'm ready now. I think I'm ready for this work to be rejected because it's so deeply my truth. That I'm okay with someone coming along and saying, Paul, this is shit, you are a fuckface. I'm like, yeah, I can handle that now. Whereas I think the previous attempts I've been almost attempting to write in such a manner whereby I was appeasing the reader as opposed to almost writing as if it was therapy. Like, I say to people who ask me for business advice all the time, how do you think of so much content? My answer is always the same. I'm writing to A, my target audience member that I can actually help, and B, I'm writing to my most insecure self. It's therapy in many respects. So when people come along and challenge me, and it's only happened a handful of times, this post is shit, I'm like, I understand that because me and you are coming from very different places and experiences. What I hear is this post doesn't apply to you, but you've been a little bit meaner about it, but that's fine. But I'm ready now. I think something clicked this week where I'm ready to be judged for a book. If I self-publish it, if I get it done, if I get it complete, if the concept is ripped apart by people, if it's not well received, I think I'm ready. I think I'm ready to have someone look at it and go, okay, let's see what you got. Let's see what 30 years of experience has taught you.
I look forward to reading it. As to be fair, I do read a lot of books, so it'll be relatively easy for me to get through it compared to, I'm sure you slugged and grinded through my one as the first physical book you read.
No, I didn't, because I was in Thailand on holiday and I mean, like, holidays are amazing, but do you know when you kind of take a day off and you're just a bit like, oh, shit, like the afternoon, oh shit. So then you just kind of sit in a deck chair and read a book. That's why I started reading a book.
No, I didn't know that. I actually didn't know the context of it. That's the beauty, and I won't spend too much because it's kind of a concept that a handful of people listening to this podcast will know about, book writing, etc. But it's therapy. Like I said to you, I said it to you and Trish the day we recorded the New Year's podcast, because my book had just come out a couple of weeks before that, or it was actually came out that day we recorded it. Podcast came out a couple of weeks later. And I was like, look, if nothing happens, but, you know, my mum and my sister buy that book, I'm like, the therapy I got from having to kind of dig into it. I think that's why the book connected so deeply with people. Like, that's, it's so different from my first one, The Fitness Mindset, which is kind of just an easy pickup. Here's some stuff on fitness, here's some stuff on mindset, where the one you read is very deep, and the people it connects with, it connects deeply with. I'm like, because I'm literally, as you said, writing to a younger self. I'm writing the book I needed when I was 24. I'm writing the book I needed when I was 25. And I think if you do that, and you're doing that with your current book, it's just going to connect so deeply with people, because you're putting it out there. Because if you've worked through that and you've processed it and you came out the other side, I personally have the belief system, and again, I've spoken about belief systems and ideas, but one of the belief systems I hold is, like, if you have something like that in you, I'm like, you need to, you owe it to people to get it out, whether it's in a book, whether it's starting a podcast, whether it's promoting a message on social media. I'm like, you get better with being ready to be rejected or being ready to be judged when you are clear that your message can help other people. And I think that everybody has a version in that. Like, I always think of when I speak to you, particularly the early days, Paul, and this is the fucking cheesiest line ever, but this is the internal thought I think. Like, you know, I try and do this with Holly. Like, one of the philosophies I have with parenting, and I'm not giving parenting advice, but I'm fucking definitely not the expert on that. But I can say one thing I try and do is, like, I always try and speak to what I call speak to her greatness. I'm like, when I'm challenging her with things, I'm like, I'm trying to speak to that greatness that's in her. And you were very similar when I met you first. I remember when we would talk, I'm like, I'm trying to speak to the greatness that's in you. I'm like, I can fucking see it. I'm like, it's there. I'm like, and that's what I'm speaking to. And I think it's important that the people around you speak to that. I think it's important that your mentors or your friends or potentially family members, if you're very lucky, they speak to that greatness. And that greatness is relative. That might be just being a fantastic mom or dad, or, you know, getting on a weight loss journey so that you can inspire others. It might be writing a book. It might be starting a business. It's so relative. But I think it's important that the people around you speak to that side of you, because that not only lifts them, it lifts you. And I genuinely think everybody has something out there that could potentially help the world in a positive way. And it's just very much right, asking the right questions until you get to the root of it, and then just surrounding yourself with the right people who can bring it out of you.
Yeah, and I feel very privileged and very fortunate to have been very much under that guidance, under that mentor from you, that you were the one who told me, you're an entrepreneur, you're not an employee. I had never considered it before, which is bananas, because I actually do think, just with being the personality traits I've been blessed with, I actually do think they're very entrepreneurial. And I never saw it until you said it to me while I was with you. Like, you were the one that said, you'll be ready to do your own thing in no time, very casually. I'll always be grateful for that. And yes, you're right about the therapy thing. You know, in the book that I've been writing so far, I just very briefly mentioned that, like, I would have had very distorted eating habits, borderline eating disorder when I was younger. And the competing in bodybuilding really re-triggered that back in me again. Now, I don't blame bodybuilding, because many people bodybuild and do fine, but I wasn't internally right. It was not the bodybuilding that warped me. It was that internal pursuit of a perfect body that I was under the illusion I could obtain, and doing it for the wrong reasons. But I've kind of touched very briefly on that in the first few drafts of the book. My goal with this book is kind of my coaching philosophy and everything. If any of my clients are listening to this, they'll know the book cover to cover already. They'll know the whole thing. And if you've never heard of me before, one of the small things I'll be touching on is, don't sacrifice your self-esteem or your identity in some bizarre illusion or some fake illusion that any kind of perfection exists, because our life is day to day and moment to moment. And it has been so far, even though it's only a few thousand words in and four chapters, it's been therapy. And it's really reminded me that I'm very grateful that I've left behind a life of just troubled eating in my youth. And I'm very grateful to that younger man, very grateful to everything he went through, very grateful to what he struggled for, so that 30-year-old me could use his suffering as a little bit more insight and wisdom. And then I hold off on saying wisdom because I haven't had to learn it the hard way. I've had no bereavement, no grief, nothing to work through per se, just life experience. So wisdom, maybe not the right word, but I'm very grateful for that young man to what he did for me. So like I say, if the book is well received and it gets one people thinking in a different way, I will take that as a huge success. And if it doesn't, I'll try again.
I love it. I've no doubt that it will, again, from all the stuff. And just to kind of pull it full circle before we kind of go into your closing thoughts, like, I don't want what I've said there about Paul to be like, oh, I helped Paul in his journey. I'm like, it's been 50-50 equally. Like, I'm literally,
I'm not shy about telling your role. I'm interrupting you on purpose. You don't need to downplay it. I would have no problem. I don't say it that much on air, for example, but I say it about you all the time. Yeah, he's not a bad lad. He's not terrible, RB, right?
But made like it's genuine. It's on both sides. When I was talking about how important it is to be around the right people and the people that see the greatness in you, whether that's the language they use or not, like there's no way that I would be able to hit that value of peace of mind if I wasn't using you as a reference point. If I wasn't using, I've got so much that I haven't touched on in this podcast from even observing the likes of you and Orla and how you show up and how, like, you had a line that I'm going to bring to my grave. Is that, you know, if you, I remember you said it to me, I can't remember, was it in Galway or was it in Vietnam, but I remember you telling me, because you're years gone out with Orla now, the line that, you know, if I act like I did at the beginning, there'll never be an end. And I'm like that's a fucking fantastic line. I'm like, you know, and it's something that those little nuggets add up over the years. So even though I've helped you with the business side, you don't even know how much that's helped me in terms of kind of growing to become a better version of myself and kind of leaning into the target self, for to stick with the theme of today's podcast. So I think it's important that those listening understand that from both of our sides, it's, you know, reciprocated on both sides, and it's important that the people around you do it for you in whatever area of your life you're trying to improve. So that's just my public acknowledgement to that, Paul. Just I know you know that already, but just so it's kind of publicly and out there in the podosphere as well, Paulie.
One sec, before you go, before you wrap this up, very kind of you, and I'm humbled, and I really do mean that, so thank you. Interesting you say that about the Orla line. I actually forgot I said that, to tell you the truth. But when we started dating, me and Orla, I said to her something to the effect of, what do you want to do for date night? And she was just kind of saying, what the hell do you mean date night? We're boyfriend and girlfriend. What the hell is date night? And this isn't my first long-term relationship. I'm a little bit older than her. And I was like, we need a date night, trust me. And she was like, we're going out, you know, date night is stupid. And she did it. She's great banter. Orla's my best friend. She's so much fun. But I think it was about a month ago, she just kind of looked at me. We're getting a bit boring now in our old age. She goes, we need date night. And I was like, we need date night. I told you we need a date night. You didn't believe me. We need date night. We need date night. We're just over 5 years together now. And it's so easy to retreat into, like, hey, I can't wait to see you. And, you know, take your clothes off, all the way to, you know, give it 10 minutes to use the bathroom, because we live together now. And you need to keep the magic alive somehow, whether it's a bit of banter or whether it's an actual date night. But yeah, it's just interesting that you said that. That's actually a nice reminder for me, by the way, so thank you for that.
Not at all. It's something that was a brain tattoo as soon as you said it, and as life circumstances change on my side, it's one that I remind myself of. Paulie, again, round fucking 50 million that we've done on the podcast, I always get something from every single episode we do. So I can't thank you enough for your time. Do you have any closing thoughts for people listening in anything that we've talked on today, or even something new that you want to end the podcast with?
Nothing other than what I've said. I appreciate being on this podcast. You know, you always have that kind of internal dichotomy of, I can't wait to speak, versus what the fuck am I saying? So I'm always very grateful for the opportunity to speak. I it's so much fun, dude. Thanks so much. This has been amazing. Thank you.
Mate, pleasure's all mine. And for those of you listening, I will link everything. If you're not following Paul on Instagram, go check out his Instagram page. It'll be linked in the description. Check out his podcast. Check out his social media. Check out his Medium. Actually, if you're interested in blogging, that is definitely the platform I would recommend checking out first, because Paul is a fantastic writer. On that note, Paul, is there anywhere else you'd like to send people, or are the ones I've mentioned the ones that you're still spending the most time on?
Yeah, no, that's all good. I'm a lot less active on social. I said the anonymous thing earlier, testing a little bit of less activity on social media this month just to see. So that's perfect, dude. I appreciate it. Thanks for the shout out.
My pleasure. And they are linked in the show notes. Paulie D, thank you so much again.
Until next time.
So there you go. Another episode with Paul Dermody. Very obvious nutritional split for the first half of today's episode, and then a lot of mindset and life stuff for the second half. So I hope you enjoyed it. And if you've got this far, hopefully it connected with you. And be sure to let me know on Instagram. Hit me and Paul up, or Paul and I up on Instagram. Brian_Keen_fitness. Thank you again to today's sponsors, Udo's Choice, Super 8 Goals. Go check them out as well. Their link is in the description. That's everything from this week's podcast. Catch you all next week.